Whoa, whoa, whoa. Scott, what are you doing?
I'm playing the intro song to Flash Gordon.
The 1936 intro?
Oh, yeah, okay. Sci-Fi Malady, Symptom 150, Flash Gordon.
Flash! Ah, it's a song by Queen!
I didn't know how to do that, Sickies. I have the Queen song, which is catchy, or I could just do the old, it's the Queen, you know, whatever. Anyway, welcome back, Sickies, to Matinee May 4. Flash Gordon. And before I go on, though, guys, I mean, Thomas, you've been around a while, but Scott, episode 150.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that until it came out of my mouth to start the podcast. 150 of these. And I remember the first attempted Lost podcast we did that went like 30 minutes and it was horrible. Like, I
wish you had those still.
Well, it's definitely gotten better.
Oh, for sure.
We have come a long way.
I just wish I could hear the first one where we were whining about DLC. That was our topic. It wasn't even sci-fi. It was just practice. Yep. We talked about DLC.
Yeah, I think that was the one where I broke a chair in the middle of the podcast. It just collapsed on me.
That is correct. So, in fact, if you go back to the few first episodes, where you hear the very beginning intro and you hear Nick going, you guys ever see the movie Looper? And you hear, whoa, that was Scott breaking the chair and falling out of it.
Yeah, we came a long way, man. I had like 4 discount microphones I picked up from Guitar Center on a plastic folding table using Audacity inside of a like cheap mixing board that I had picked up from Guitar Center. And just trying to figure out how to get this thing to work. I don't even know. We didn't even have intro music that time, I think. I was like, we'll have this later.
maybe we did because,
it was Quick Rants that didn't have intro music at first. I had intro music for Sci-Fi Malady by the time we started.
Yeah. Yeah. It was that like House of the Rising Sun knockoff.
I still like that one. I don't know what happened to it. That was one of my favorite intro bits.
Oh, I don't miss it. But anyway, before we go take a walk down memory lane, we have to take a walk down to matinee lane. But before we even do that, first I want to do a nice little shout out to Ethan. Thank you once again for your comment. And thank you for weighing in on my side, even though Scott already ceded the floor. But it's still nice to know that I have my audience, that I have my argument with me.
And we have a convert.
I have a convert. I'll take the one. You know, that's how it starts, right? So the just as a way of saying thanks for being a listener, thanks for staying with us and commenting, we want to send you a little gift. We want to send you a shirt. We have Sci-Fi Malady t-shirts. And if you're interested in that, please go ahead and send us an email. Send Scott an email with an address you're comfortable with and your shirt size. And this is a free thing from us. This is a thank you from us. So just go ahead and anytime you hear this, just send us your contact info where we can send it, whether it be a P.O. box or whatever, and your shirt size. Yep. And we'll send that off. We will expedite that quickly.
Ethan, whatever's easiest for you, you can direct message me at Twitter at Scott2824, or you can just email it to me at Scott2824@iCloud.com.
Sure.
Just want to say thank you for being a listener. It's you know, it's wonderful to know we're not just talking to ourselves each week and to get some feedback and to know that, you know, someone's out there really enjoying this show. So thank you, Ethan.
Absolutely. So getting into Flash Gordon, I think I'm going to put this out there so we don't have to belabor the point, but it doesn't translate well. And for those, let's just be honest, for those that are sensitive to this issue, my solution for you is just don't watch anything before 2016. That way you can be sure that nothing's going to affect sensibilities, because there's a lot of, like we did with Spaceballs. There's some things that are going to bug you if you're that concerned about jokes or things in poor taste or things that don't translate well. I think that's true of anything prior to 2016. There's going to be things that don't translate well. So when it says that there's, when it shows that people are panicking in Africa, like Africa's a country, and there's a bunch of natives jumping around, yeah, it doesn't translate well. Yes, when the bleach blonde white savior is doing everything, that doesn't translate well. Yes, the one woman is just trying to, the ladies are fighting over Flash and they're getting nasty and the rest of the time they're just screaming. Yes, it doesn't translate well. It's tropey, I know, but we're not going to evaluate it based on that merit. So, and then this isn't Sci-Fi Malady getting political. This is just flat out saying, if these are things that bother you, just don't watch it.
You know, I've always said this is
because there's nothing you can do to change it now. It's 1936.
It's a film from another era. And I mean, you can't go evaluate a film from another era by today's moral and ethical standards and say they should have done better. And that'll be an unpopular opinion to people. But all of the woken progressives today will be listening to their kids or their grandkids 30 to 50 years from now, appalled at their moral behavior in 2020. And trust me, it will. Your grandkids will look and say, we're not ignorant and backwards like you guys were in 2020. This is 2060. Right. We know better.
Yeah. Right.
You are always correct.
Right. So, and that's why I said, if you have those kind of sensitivities, just don't watch anything prior to 2016. Because something is going to step on your nerve.
Now that you did bring it up, the points were pretty much yes. There were definitely some points in this where you could go, wow, that's a little racist. And definitely points where you go, that is sexist.
Yeah. You know what, though? Okay, it's racist. But without knowing the individuals making this, and I'm not about to be devil's advocate for racism here, so I'm just going to stop here.
That's a good ejection. I'll just say, like, if you want to hit it on the head, like, the sexism is obvious. Dale is useless. She just faints over and over again and screams while Flash is fighting. And look at it beyond this.
Yeah.
Flash and Ming are fighting for the right to marry and basically own Dale. I mean, at least Flash does say, what if my choice of bride turns me down? But Dale is literally out there as a trophy to be won.
And don't forget, the princess also wants Flash. That whole bit, yeah.
Right, and that's the other trope, the deceitful, manipulative, evil woman.
Yep.
Right. So that's why I wanted to get that out of the way now, so that we can move past that, because it's there. There's nothing we can do about it. And it's something that doesn't translate well and didn't continue on into modern day. Allegedly, there's going to be a remake with what's his name? Taika Waititi of Thor Ragnarok. So obviously those things won't be in it.
Okay. Well, I mean, the other things that obviously don't translate well is technology and stuff like that.
Well, of course, but that, you know that going into it. Into something this old, you know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's a different time, so different things. You're going to have some tropes, you're going to have some of this, and you're also going to have technology that you just roll your eyes at and go, that's stupid.
You're telling me that you can't get in a rocket ship that's going to blast off from the Earth and just hold on to a rail like you're on a subway car and be okay as it lifts off into orbit?
You're fine. Since we're going to do that, here we go. According to non-spacefaring people of that time, I guess they did the best they could with what little they knew about space and space travel. J.J. Abrams, on the other hand, has access to what space travel is and would make something like that. So
I'm just wondering,
I'm gonna give 1936 guy that doesn't know anything about space travel, nor does he have any access to knowledge of that, a break. I will not give it to J.J. Abrams.
And there's your bashing of J.J. Abrams for the week.
any chance I get.
You're telling me advanced civilization that can move a planet around wouldn't fight with swords?
That's why they call it space opera.
I very much feel that Frank Herbert might have been influenced by this. I just started seeing parallels to Dune.
You know what? We're going to get to that. So let me just jump in to do this. So I've gotten the disclaimer out of the way. The basic information, I guess I'll take that one up today because I did the homework today. The production, it was made in 1936 based on a comic strip, Flash Gordon, 1934. And it was made actually in response to the serial Buck Rogers. And it was Republic trying to cash in on that. And it stars Buster Crabb as Flash Gordon, who was incidentally an Olympic swimmer, by the way. And who else was in it? I just lost my list here. Buster Crabb, Gene Rogers as Dale, Charles Middleton, Priscilla Lawson as Aurora, and Frank Shannon, who I believe played Ming the Merciless, the bad guy. But that is the cast. And this film allegedly was made for $1 million, but some other sources say it was $350,000. Either way, pretty big for its time.
And that's a big discrepancy between those two.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
But still, a lot, I guess. And of course, like all good serials, it borrows a lot of props and cutscenes from other films like Frankenstein or The Mummy or The Invisible Road.
The Diamond was from the movie we reviewed.
What's that? Phantom Creeps?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of the electrical equipment was from Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, which I love. So it's all electricity stuff. The
Egyptian, also a lot of stock.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the Egyptian statues and iconography came from The Mummy, Boris Karloff's Mummy from 32. Zarkov's rocket ship and scenes of dancers on that gigantic idol were from 1930's Just Imagine. So it had a lot of its borrowing. My favorite fact about this movie is that Buster Crabb had to have his hair dyed blonde. And he hated it because for whatever reason, people were whistling at him. And he hated that. So he just didn't do it. He would put a hat on until he was done making the show. And also, in fact, Gene Rogers, who played Dale, had her hair dyed blonde so she could look like Jean Harlow, who was the big time heartthrob of Hollywood at the time. So they were trying to capitalize on that. I mean, let's just be honest. Part of the reception is that Jean Harlow and Priscilla Lawson were scantily clad. And that was pure sex appeal right there. Let's just be honest. In fact, the whole idea was to try to make sci-fi action thrillers palpable to adults in addition to combating Buck Rogers. And part of it was the sex appeal. Bring in the guy by scantily clad women.
And that has carried on in science fiction forever. I mean, let's look at Return of the Jedi and Leia's metal bikini.
Oh, absolutely.
It hasn't gone away. Star Trek Enterprise was entirely based around how they could sexualize T'Pol in every episode.
Sure. Especially later seasons.
The first episode, they threw in a whole scene in the decon chamber with the three main stars standing in there in their underwear, lathering each other up with gel.
I forgot about that.
The guy that played Trip was trying to say that, with all this camera crew there, it was about as exciting as a visit to the dentist. But it's like, but we don't see that.
Don't forget about the whole episode where they have Freudian slips from Archer saying things to T'Pol.
You're right, Scott. That is a total thing. It's what they do.
It's never gone away.
Yep. Yeah.
and it probably never will, let's be honest.
Right. In fact, and so it was well received, though, in the fact that it got two sequels, Flash Gordon's Trip to Mars and Flash Gordon Conquers the Universe. So those were, and of course, this got re-releases in the 50s and 60s. So this was a very popular serial. And of course, it went on, and later on, there was a movie in 82. I remember Atari games playing that. There was cartoons in the 70s and 80s. Then, of course, we're going to probably get the new one from Taika Waititi, I think. So, no, this led to a whole thing.
I don't know if you mentioned this, but the serial film was immediately almost released into a 72-minute feature in 1936, which was Universal's second highest film of that year. Gross income. Wow. Yeah.
Well, that shows you how popular it was. Well, it was reissued in 49 as Rocket Ship. Yeah.
It's understandable. I mean, there's a, you know, I'm always a Star Trek guy. If you watch Star Trek Voyager, Tom Paris does the Captain Proton holodeck program, which absolutely is a callback to this. And it's a lot of what you see in Flash Gordon translates over to that whole little sidebar. I mean, it's an influential serial and film and comic strip that has had, it's impacted a lot of stuff that has come after it. And I can understand why it's still around today. Almost 100 years later.
You can say Flash Gordon and people know what you're talking about.
That's true. Except for modern kids, but whatever.
Well, yeah. Okay. Let's put it, most people would know what you're talking about.
This was my first exposure to Flash Gordon.
Okay.
But you'd heard of him.
I'd heard of it. I had no idea what it was.
Okay. But you'd heard of it.
You still heard of it. So,
and that's the point.
You knew Flash Gordon existed.
Right. You were aware of it at the very least. And the fact that it survived that long.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. It's gone into, at least somewhat, into the natural pop culture.
Yes.
And it's there. Kind of like Star Wars, Star Trek. It's in there. It exists. Some people know more about it than others, but people know it's there.
Right. So, you know, Sky, you talked a lot about influences. We're going to get an influence. So, but first, let me give my one paragraph synopsis, because this is a 13-part serial. It's not worth going into detail. Just to say that Planet Mongo is going to crash into Earth. And the big astronomers who notice this, one of them has a son, Flash, who is in an air, who winds up. Yeah. Flash, with some woman he meets, Dale, run into a guy named Dr. Zarkov, who developed a rocket to go to the planet to stop it from hitting Earth. And he gets Flash and Dale to go with him. And they meet the emperor of the planet, Ming the Merciless, and they get into a long adventure, meeting different kings and princes, trying to stop Ming from actually colliding into Earth. And of course, they succeed in defeating him, his forces, and Ming winds up killing himself because I guess he can't bear to lose. And they just stop the planet from crashing into Earth and come home as heroes. That's about all you need to know. So, but let's get into influences. So Scott mentioned one, and I think, as always, it's easy to point out Star Wars. I mean, most of these serials are going to somehow, in some way, inspire Star Wars.
Yeah, but get upset at me about this, but I still have to ask if George Lucas ever had an original idea. Before he made A New Hope, he wanted to try to do a Flash Gordon movie in the 70s and couldn't get it greenlit. And it's very easy for me to see the similarities between the overall structure of A New Hope and a 13-part serial.
Well, Flash Gordon picked stuff from mythology, so...
Wait, you mean lightsabers and swords are similar? I what?
Who knew? Who knew? But of course, you have an evil emperor, an evil kingdom.
Damsel in distress.
Yep. Rocket ships and all that stuff. It's clear. It's clear just from the way the text crawls are telling you what the story is about. That's all so influential into Star Wars. I don't think it's worth just it's a space opera. It's a space fantasy And that's what Star Wars is.
What
so
it makes me wonder,
that.
What it makes me wonder about A New Hope is if you broke it up into 12 parts and ran it in a serial faction, would it work? And I think the answer is there's not enough running time to it, but I think it could work if you broke it up into a serial the way George Lucas did it. That's probably why it had to be changed in editing like it did to recut the film to make sense. I think he was big time influenced by this style.
That could be. Now, Scott, you mentioned an impact on Dune. I'm interested in hearing what you have to say about that. What would be the influence on Dune?
Purely conjecture here. Purely conjecture that Frank Herbert might have.
We do plenty of that here, so keep it up.
But it's it's the sword fighting. It's a spacefaring technological civilization that has reverted to medieval times and titles. Princes, kings, emperors. There's a feudalism type of thing going on here where all of these places have their own local leaders that are flowing up to Emperor Ming and paying tribute. There's something about, I don't want to call it a used future, because Dune is more of what if you went to feudal Europe but gave them the ability to fly through space, but then restricted their technology because they don't want to make a machine in the mind of a man. So it's not that far yet, but this whole concept of a feudalized future where you're still fighting with swords and breastplates and knives, it could or couldn't be an influence on Dune. Dune is not near as action-packed as Flash Gordon, but it's just I kept hearkening, nice pun there, to Dune with some of these titles and the somewhat feudal nature of it.
Okay, that makes sense. You also mentioned the Star Trek
and kingdoms and stuff. I see that.
What about you mentioned Star Trek? Something about Star Trek in a holodeck episode?
You gotta go watch Star Trek Voyager, and Tom Paris creates his Captain Proton program where he and Harry Kim are off to constantly fight Dr. Chaotica in Captain Proton's rocket ship.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah. One of the best episodes is Bride of Chaotica, because there's photonic beings that are living in like some nebula, and Dr. Chaotica is attacking the photonic beings with his death ray. And Janeway has to come in as the Bride of Chaotica and the Spider Queen to sabotage the entire Dr. Chaotica's operation.
Oh man, I remember that. Now that you mentioned it, I totally remember that. You're right.
Captain Proton is a lot like Flash Gordon, except his sidekick Harry Kim doesn't really fit with being a Dr. Zarkov, but it's very similar. You can see the influences.
Oh, it's definitely an homage. Absolutely. It's definitely going to Flash Gordon and that type of venture. I mean, even the spacecraft they were in the holodeck, it was like, yeah, that's totally a Flash Gordon ship.
I'll say it's so well done. I wish they would have done a spinoff of Voyager called Captain Proton. It would probably have been better than Voyager, but, you know.
The Adventures of... That would have been interesting.
I don't know if this is an influence, but it was my first introduction to how Flash Gordon started, how I was introduced, was the Muppet Babies, because the Muppet Babies would often use stock footage of old stuff, and they use Flash Gordon's spaceships a lot in their shows. Whenever like Gonzo was pretending he was flying in space, they would show Flash Gordon rockets. So.
Thanks, Rage Master. Now the theme song to Muppet Babies is stuck in my head.
Hey, there you go. That was a good show, man. Good show.
It was?
I was watching it last Saturday for kicks. Saturday morning cartoons day.
The voice of Scooter is also the voice of Donatello in a couple seasons of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
That makes sense now that as soon as you said Scooter, I started thinking of it going, yeah, that makes sense. All right. I mean, he's no Lorenzo Music, but... Yeah. So, any other influences we could think of how Flash Gordon has impacted other storytelling beyond just George, the space opera, space fantasy in and of itself?
I think it just sets a template for what came after.
It's such a early one of it. I mean, you pretty much anything that came after, you can point back and say it's influencing it some way or somehow. I mean, literally the one hero coming from a separate planet to save the, I mean, things like that. You can point to a million times when it comes up.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a way, it's kind of like John Carter, you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs' story. But it, you know, there's a saying among a lot of hard rock metalheads that Alice Cooper did it first. Like, just picture any wild stage show or song, and most people be able to go, well, Alice Cooper did it first. Alice Cooper did that first. Or like in that South Park episode, where every time they tried to find something the Simpsons hadn't done, they're like, oh, no, the Simpsons did that in episode blah, blah, blah. And I think that's what Flash Gordon is. Every time you point out a science fiction, sci-fi, fantasy trope, particularly, be it from even that movie Dark Matter, remember that show we did, you can point out and say Flash Gordon did that first. Flash Gordon did that. Flash Gordon did that. And that makes the influence. And that's what I always talk about, how inspire the next thing. You don't have to do Flash Gordon again, but let it inspire something new and great. And that's what I wish we would do now. And the problem is that's why we have franchises now. And I'm going to say that as long as there's a franchise like Marvel succeeding, it's going to be a glut of ideas for the time being, because you're not going to get a corporation to roll the dice.
I would love for modern entertainment to be more groundbreaking and trend setting, but it's not an easy thing you're asking. It's not easy to come up with the next Star Wars. It's not easy to come up with the next Flash Gordon.
I know that, but at the same, there was a lot of things. It was a lot like the Renaissance. Certain factors were contributing. I get that. But you can't have that if you've just decided, well, franchise are where it's at, and if you're not going to do a franchise, we're not going to do it.
Then, but in any era,
any shot you had is gone.
In any era of entertainment, how many shows are truly groundbreaking and influential in that they changed the whole landscape of entertainment and people moved to be like that? I mean, you talk about Marvel. The Marvel Cinematic Universe probably will be looked at 20 to 30 years from now as something influential and new and groundbreaking, in that they were the first guys to really sit here and say, we're going to release a whole bunch of different movies that are all telling a part of a story and bring them all together in a conclusion.
Without a doubt. But it's going to be like MTV was to the music scene. It helped, but it hurt. And that's what MCU did. It helped create this really fantastic thing, but it also hurt, because then everybody wanted to do that, and everybody sucks at it except Marvel.
Oh,
okay. I'm going to say this. There is also the thing you have to remember, and Scott is right. This has happened every time. Shakespeare. He wrote awesome plays. He wrote those plays. Everyone basically tried to copy him at the time. Same thing with, you know, books, art, anything that has come out. Art is almost probably a better example. You can find a famous artist, and at that time, Rousseau or something, at that time, you have about a million copycats of that guy. So this always happens in any art form. Someone makes something new, something that's good, something that's out there brand new, profitable. And you're suddenly going to have copycats everywhere trying to get a piece of that. It happens every time. So
absolutely.
You can't say it's new or it's anything like that. You have to go, it's expected. It's going to happen. This is just the newest iteration of the trend. And because of that, you will see it.
Right. But I guess what I'm trying to say is you can foster an environment where we're going to, ideally, something will become groundbreaking, or at least the environment by which it could happen is there. Or you create this is the sandbox you have to play in, and if you don't like it, well, this is what you're working on, and that's it. Well, I mean, and that's when you get guys who want to play the corporate game. That's when you get people that just want to schmooze into a franchise that already exists and tap it for what it's worth. And, you know, the people that are buying these franchises like Star Wars or Star Trek, they're not creative types. They're just buying it to add it to a portfolio.
Well, yes, but you always have the option. It's always there. Someone can always make, if they come up with a good idea, a brand new idea, they can make it. It's not like you can't do it.
Well, there's certain financial barriers. That's my point. Like, if you got to remember, you're looking at corporate America, who is risk adverse. They don't want to take a risk. They don't want to roll the dice and try something new, hypothetically, but then they make a bunch of crap and they risk that. So you tell me where that is. But instead of, they take the wrong risks, let's say, or they take none. And so I'm just trying to say is when you're trying to have, if when everyone's view is franchise, gotta get a franchise, build a franchise, buy a franchise, it's like, well, okay, Marvel did it, but apparently lightning isn't striking twice. So, and I'm willing to bet a good reason Marvel is successful is because you have the right person running it. Now, of course, Scott will point out the next gen of Marvel movies might be a glut, and I agree with him. It makes me wonder where they're going from here. Endgame put them in a position of, okay, what now? I mean, you just hit a high point. Where are you going from now? Shang-Chi? Wow, a Bruce Lee guy, a Bruce Lee knockoff. Yeah, that's gonna be a good follow-up after Endgame. That's gonna keep me engaged, sure. And I already know, Scott, Shang-Chi, you don't know who he is and you couldn't care less.
That's the problem. that's the problem.
Not to turn this into a Marvel discussion, but up until now, you've primarily had some solid material. And I mean, I'm not saying they're out, but eventually I hope they are, because how long can this go on? Scott, you've even mentioned it, and I agree with you. You can't just keep this going.
Exactly. So, something new will come along, and it always does.
I hope so. So.
Oh, that's not good. Continue.
Oh, okay.
So, I think Mountain Dew got spilled.
Again? I'm telling you. Okay, I keep telling you guys this. Whenever I'm at the table, near the table, or in this case, even symbolically at the table, and if there's Mountain Dew, it will spill. I keep telling you this curse, and nobody listens to me.
That's why I bring Dr. Pepper to gaming sessions.
Yes, for some reason, years of Matthew T. Weaver drinking gallons and gallons and liters of Dr. Pepper never spilled near me. Never. Can a Mountain Dew? It's falling over. Don't know how, but it will. Just wait. So Scott needs to learn his lesson on that.
Fair enough. Yeah. But we also do have the thing of this film. Well, I serial, I should say.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't a film. It's manageable, because you did mention earlier it's 13. But
yeah.
It's short, 13.
That is. I felt that way, yeah.
I mean, it's like 20 minutes an episode, and like the first, I mean, you have a scrawl at the beginning telling you what happened last time, and then a quick like minute, 2 minutes of the whole 20 minutes is recap of what you just saw last time.
Yeah, the last minute of the last episode, so you can catch up.
Right. So it might have been 13. It was 13 parts, but it didn't feel that long. It didn't drag.
Yeah.
Last week, I will say, at points felt like it was dragging. This didn't.
Okay.
This kept having much more action and moving from action to action to action. I mean, sometimes this way didn't make sense.
Yeah.
But it jumped from action to action. I mean, literally fight to fight to fight.
Right.
Some of them are pretty good. Some are stupid. We were doing the stupid fight again, but others were really well choreographed.
I was never bored.
No. And I would say, going back to the connective tissue there, Thomas, the episodes, since, let's just dive into what we like, the 20 minutes never felt dragged out. It wasn't like come on, when is this going to end? And I really liked when they gave you the synopsis of the previous, what had been going on before. It ends with Flash sees, or Flash is being taken to the Tunnel of Terror. When? ... Or it says, until ... And it's like, ooh, that's a really good way to say that and lead into the next episode. And then they show you the last minute or two of the last episode, so you're not going, wait, what? So that was
And they spliced it very well. Because it wasn't a harsh cut at any point, and the cuts were really well done at points that allowed them to transition the story without abruptness, giving you time to acclimate yourself back into it. I mean, we watched it back to back, but I could see going into the theater and watching it, the acclimation allowing you to re-trigger those memories and remember what happened.
Right.
I will say, I think it was a simpler story than the ones that we watched the last 2 weeks, and I think that helped it. I think that helped. I don't want to say it's hack and slash, but it's hack and slash. And that allowed you to have you had a simple plot. You had a simple objective. Stop the planet Mongo from crashing into Earth. Once that happened, it was get back to Earth and prevent Ming the Merciless or Emperor Ming from taking Dale as his wife. And then it became survive. And you just threw them into ordeals that they had to survive. And that allows you to be focused with your writing and have everything make sense and progress logically. You could call it a by the numbers script, but it helps. It helps make it enjoyable. It helps make the plot make sense and not become convoluted.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, you did have, let me try to phrase this delicately, simple characters.
Yeah, that's true. They were.
Flash Gordon is a big hunking brute of a man who just beats on people. I mean, literally, he's held back in most episodes from getting himself in trouble. Don't start a fight right now because you'll lose.
You'll lose.
Right. And you have that. You have one king of the Hawk people who just laughs. I mean, his whole character is just...
fighting style is great, too, because it's like Andre the Giant and the Earthquake in wrestling. He just take run at him and he bumps you back with his big belly and laughs at you.
Yeah.
And it works.
Every single character here is very, very simplistic and very much paint by the numbers. Once you know what they are, they don't change from it, and they're simple as can be.
Yeah, you want to talk about a one-dimensional villain.
That's it.
Ming is evil because he's evil.
Yeah.
The only nuanced character might be the princess.
Yes. I want to conquer the universe. No reason why.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Well, actually, I would. It leaves us before we find out what she does. So we don't know. I mean, the entire time we've watched her manipulate and work behind the scenes doing pretty nasty stuff at times.
Yeah, for sure.
Doesn't seem like she has any problem with any of this going on either.
Mm-hmm.
So she could definitely be evil also. Wouldn't put her on the good side.
You know what's neat about this too is that on planet Mongo. The what's that?
Mongo.
Jeez, how did I forget that? there was actually a religion. And it was Torin, I think it was called. And it was that idea that you could still have that in space. Because I think, too, I'm not for sure, but when you look at something like some science fiction writers of the late 19th century, there was this almost belief that we would transcend that, that there'd be no more. And we'd all jump into, you know, as H.G. Wells thought, we'd all jump into socialism. There'd be no more religion and war. And it's kind of like the authors are saying, oh, yeah, well, that Great War thing just basically showed you you were wrong. So I think that's a neat thing that they put that in there, that it's more of that became influential later on. So,
yeah, it's interesting. Most science fiction tends to remove religion from the equation, but some science fiction does leave it in. Dune left it in significantly, and this serial left it in as well.
You could, well, this is the thing. With space and religion, many times it's easier to take it out. Just take it out and not even deal with it.
Uh-huh.
Just for the simplicity's sake.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as you start playing with it, then you start coming across problems of religion often comes about naturally because of how humans are. We order ourselves in certain orders naturally. And society, we like groups and in-groups and tribes and things like that. And this is another way of dividing ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And if you start playing with things like that, you can get very tricky and start having problems with it. And oftentimes, if you're a writer or director, take it. It's easier just to go, I don't want to deal with it. We'll just take it out.
That's true.
Because then you can tell your story without having to deal with any extra bits that can get in the way.
Yeah. Plus, you don't have to get any of the ethical issues that might crop up. It's like, well, it's gone. We don't have to deal with it.
Right. And not saying this kind of got in the way at all, but
no.
In some cases, I think it's easier just to take it out and make sure it doesn't.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as you talked about, you know, why religion wasn't prevalent in some of our early science fiction, particularly that stuff that came in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. You know, if you look at the big three science fiction writers who really are the kings of the early genre, with Clark and with Heinlein and with Asimov, these guys are scientists. And scientists tend to separate from religion and write what they know. These guys were definitely, you know, going to be on that end. And a lot of scientists will think that at some point it will supplant religion, whether it will or won't. So it kind of makes sense when you see where, I know this came before them, but it kind of makes sense why in a lot of science fiction, one of the establishments of the genre was the removal of religion in the future.
Yeah. No, I could debate very easily that some people have removed religion from their life, but not religionality. They've removed the
religiousness, the spirituality or whatever. Yeah. Right.
They might have removed the actual religion, as in Christianity, you know, Islam or Buddhism or something like that, but they still have the nature and the actions of religiosity in them.
That makes sense.
Or they play pick and choosy and pick what they like and chuck the rest.
It's kind of like Shepard in Firefly telling Mal, I don't care what you believe in, just believe in something.
Right.
Any religion is good, just have one.
Right. And I could easily debate that everyone has one. It's just what you put your faith in and how you direct it. I mean, even an atheist believes in science and can put some religiosity behind it. And I'm very carefully want to phrase it, not saying things, but you can put some religiosity behind certain things.
Yeah.
That goes for people. That can go for places, that can go for ideas.
Yeah,
sure.
Can't and, disagree with any of that.
And, you know, I think, too, we'll see more of that. If you get to the 50s, you'll start to see a little bit more that the sci-fi addresses, you know, like atomic catastrophe because atom bomb. But you might see a little more science fiction in American science fiction because a way of differentiating us from the communists, you know, the godless commies, that sort of thing.
Make the difference. Yeah.
Right. So it became a little different. In episode 8, and this was just funny, there was that duel between Flash and the Mighty Masked Swordsman of Mango. And I wished it had been the Mighty Masked Mace Man of Mango, because it could be then Mango.
You also want alliteration, let's be honest.
Oh my gosh, that's what I'm about. But also, though, I found it interesting that, okay, duel, episode 8, and somehow this duel is better than the one in the throne room in Last Jedi. because there wasn't a bunch of flourishes, twirlings, and people just swinging around things like a baseball bat going, yeah!
I thought it was, you know, it was the most obvious thing ever who Flash Gordon was fighting.
Totally. Yes. Baron. Yeah, totally Baron. But hey, it was there. Oh, and remember, I think it was the same episode, 8 or 9, with after he beat Baron, he had to fight the ape beast called the Orangapoid or Orangapod.
Yes. That was right after it, yeah.
And Scott, you made the reference, which this is a positive because it's so campy. The weak spot is a spear in its throat.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I would have never thought that would kill it.
wait, you're telling me that I can kill someone by suffocating them? What?
I also like that what? Flash Gordon maintains proper fencing form with one hand behind his back with his elbow crooked
the entire fight.
when fighting to the death.
Yeah, also, let's be honest, Flash Gordon somehow has fencing lessons, science lessons, a master boxer, somehow has the physique of a Greek god.
He's a Superman.
And there's no hero's journey. There's no hero's journey. This whole film is terrible because there's no hero's journey. Where is the hero's journey?
Scott, we're going to get to that. I'm actually going to knock it for that. So don't think me too much a hypocrite. I am, because every human being's a hypocrite, but I scale it back a bit today.
The only more perfectly well-rounded human being in science fiction ever is Jean-Luc Picard, who's a master of everything. Oh, I see.
The only more perfect is Jean-Luc Picard, until now.
Yeah, until we have Flash Gordon. I guess Flash Gordon came first, so...
Actually, I was going to say until Robert Kurtzman got a hold of Picard.
True.
So, Scott, you referred to a lizard chicken lobster of death. What is that?
Well, that was in the second chapter. And then again, when you see the sacred dragon, it just to me looks like a lizard chicken monster of death. But it's the one where Flash is fighting and he gets grabbed in the pincers of the thing for a minute.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I almost said it also reminds me of Zoidberg.
Okay. Well, what are you talking about? The Zoidberg is not stuck on Planet Mango. The Zoidberg will never serve Mang.
We're definitely into rips and picks.
How about the... I don't know if the iguana's fighting.
Yeah,
let's just put it out there.
That's a good campy one.
I mean, it's both. Okay, I mean,
yeah,
campy, and I kind of enjoyed it because it was that stupid. But it's also like it's just two iguanas fighting. What?
Yeah, that was bad. Yeah, I'm just gonna say that was bad. You've obviously just put the camera real up close on iguanas to try to make them look like giant dragons.
Yeah. And then you just film two of them. That might have been the mating rather than fighting. I don't know.
Well, yeah, it was horrible. There's some things that just, even for the time, looked bad. Like the rocket ship looked... I kept thinking it looked like the pristine bullet from the JFK assassination flying through the sky on mines.
You know what, Scott? I'm going to disagree and call this a good thing. The effects... for their time, were groundbreaking. I mean, even, my wife, who calls this stuff quatch and thinks it's stupid. She watched the last few minutes of the final episode with me just because she was in the room. And she actually commented when I told her what year it was made, she commented, "Wow, this must have been really groundbreaking. This is groundbreaking for that year."
Okay. So I got to give you that.
We can sit here and say, "Oh, it looks so stupid." Yeah, by today's standard, it does. But the fact that those effects lasted until the 60s.
Hey, the sparklers of death that they were using on Flash Gordon and that when they're electrocuting him were pretty awesome, too.
Yeah.
So exactly. That stuff lasted until the 60s when people were enjoying it. So that goes to say something.
I would agree with you. The special effects are very good for the time.
Yeah.
Again, there's also bits of it where, like, literally flying a craft and shooting other craft by looking at them and pointing your spaceship at it.
Yeah.
You go, "Oh, the science is so bad."
Hey, the Sharkmen. The Sharkmen should have been taken out. You did nothing to make them look like sharks. They're just guys that live in the water. And they still need to come up to breathe. How are they Sharkmen? They don't have teeth. They don't have fins. They're just guys that like to swim.
I give them ambition points for doing underwater combat scenes.
Yeah, but that was terrible. That really was just a terrible combat scene.
I'm not saying it was fantastic, but I'm saying the ambition of the time, you hadn't seen that ever.
Okay, and how about the octopus? That was a terrible fight with an octopus. I'm sorry. That did not look like an octopus at all.
Do you know why this doesn't bug me as much? Because I've seen worse. If you ever watch the Ed Wood movie, Bride of the Monster, there's a scene in there where the doctor, the mad scientist, has an octopus, a giant mutated octopus, and it's just stock footage of an octopus up close. But in the chamber where it lives, it's an octopus monster. It was a rubber monster that they made that had this machine that moved the arms around, but they didn't have the machine. So they just put it in a room. And whenever someone was shoved into the room to be killed by the monster, the victim had to run up to it, fall into it, pick up the arms, and flail themselves at the octopus arms in order to be killed by it. So,
okay.
I'm going to go ahead and say it wasn't that. Maybe just because I've seen that this was bad, but I was still going, still beats Bride of the Monster.
Okay, yes, there was worse, but I'm still saying that was bad.
And oh, no.
You're admitting that it's bad. And you're not.
Oh, yeah. We'll not disagree, but I still have a low standard now. But no, you're right. It was bad.
Yeah. And also the Hawkmen. I'm sorry. What?
Oh, the angels, basically, the archangels. You know, that looked kind of neat the way they showed them flying in the distance. That kind of looked neat for its time.
Yeah, but you're telling me their entire civilization they formed is on a floating station that requires slave labor to
fuel
their
atom mines.
Yeah.
The fact that they were shoveling what was it they were shoveling in the atomic mines, the atomic furnace?
It was some weird named material.
Yeah, but it reminded me, Scott, you'll get this, of the Simpsons episode where Monty Burns as a boy goes in with his grandfather into an atom smashing factory, and it's people smashing giant mallets into rocks, and the guy's going, "All of you get cracking and smashing those atoms. You, pull out your pockets. What's this? Atoms." And so that's what it reminded me of. Like, before most people knew what an atomic structure was.
And it had to be a furnace because that was the concept of providing power, right? Was to fuel the furnace.
Yep.
Yes.
Well, stuff on the atomic furnace.
Well, you also had weird things with magnets. We hold the whole thing underwater with magnets.
Yeah.
You stop the rocket with the counter magnet.
Yeah.
But you know what? That's so cool, though. because that really reminds me a bit of the, now that we're talking about all the different people they meet and kingdoms they go to, it's a lot like the Odyssey, where they wind up with the shark men, then they go to Voltan's kingdom with the winged the hawk people. And before that, they meet Thune, whose kingdom is fighting Mings. And it's like Flash is meeting all these people and making allies out of them in the meantime. And it's just that whole space odyssey almost, David Bowie. But
I'm not going to disagree with you at all, because yes, it's very much the Odyssey tale.
Yeah, it's neat.
There were three characters that I really liked, and that I think that was just the it excelled in displaying and developing. And Emperor Ming is an excellent villain. He's an excellent evil for the sake of evil, and thinly developed character, not thinly developed, but he just is what he is. You know, he's yeah. evil because he's evil, and it's so well played and acted. And then Flash Gordon, obviously, and then Zarkov. I like Dr. Zarkov. He's just the wise scientist who's tagging along. He's useless in a fight. He's absent-minded, stuck in his own world on his own research. But those three characters, to me, were just superbly written and displayed and acted throughout this whole serial.
Okay.
Except for Zarkov's outfit.
All of their outfits were weird.
We're going to get to that. I just want to mention.
Just saying.
It's worth mentioning.
It's worth mentioning. The acting at least helped, because if not for the excellent acting, the outfits might have just pulled me out of it completely.
Yeah. As a few little last little bits of I like is in chapter 11, you had the tiger monster, which was really just a tiger. The way they made it look like it attacked Dale, that looked pretty good. The Tiger King abides.
Yeah, I also was thinking of Roy, and you know, I'm like, I remember a tiger attack recently, and it didn't end too well. Please tell me this was butter trained.
Yeah, well, you could tell it wasn't Dale that it attacked, but so, and of course, I also liked the way the ladies looked, but that's just me. And I think I texted this, but I want to make this clear. Every time I heard someone yell Flash, I said Thunder. Which, do you get that?
Yeah.
World War II, but I think they said Thunder first, but you know.
Yes, it was a call sign used during World War II. Yeah. Yes. Flash Gordon's father. I feel sorry for Flash. I mean, seriously, why would you name your son Flash?
Oh, I know. Maybe that was a thing.
I sure hope not.
Yeah. So, you know what? You get, you guys are, you mentioned the short, so I guess that's a good segue into the things we don't like. Why, and this is something my wife even brought up, why does Zarkov have short shorts?
Why does Flash also have short shorts?
Yeah. Why? I mean, why? That's a bad thing.
Yeah, I think the costume design was iffy in this completely.
Sure.
I mean, you have the princess in a belly dancing outfit. The emperor is wearing, I don't even know what. You have short shorts on both Gordon and scientist. Then you have Hawkman, who's, what?
They're dressed like Roman, they're like dressed like Roman soldiers.
And then you also have knights walking around in full plate armor.
Right.
And the shark people were, I don't even know what outfits those were. I mean,
yeah,
maybe Morocco?
I guess.
Maybe. I don't.
But you know what? Speaking of the guards, you know, I really wish that I'm sure the Allies were really wishing that Hitler's guards were that good. It would have made killing him a lot easier.
Beyond useless.
Flash runs into the courtroom and Ming's like, stop them. Flash still manages to run right up to Ming, put a sword to his face, and the guards are like, duh, what do we do, boss?
Well, don't forget, one of the guards was like, hey, that one place is sinking. Maybe I should tell the emperor.
Yeah.
Go away.
Yeah. Really?
I don't know if this joke is in good taste or not, but Ming's guards reacted about as fast as Kennedy's Secret Service agents.
Ooh. Well, that would be a Scott Kennison style joke right there.
Yep.
So
it's been like 50 some years. It's 57 years. It's okay, right?
Not too soon. I guess I'll do this and let you guys have at it with your whatever things you didn't like. But I'll be honest with you. There are a few things that out of purpose I have to not like. Yes, Scott, you already mentioned, so I won't belabor it, the lack of hero's journey. That's a problem for me. And two, the Abrams-style coincidences. Flash, the plane he's in, they have to jump ship, and he just happens to land near the spaceship that Zarkov has, and Zarkov just happens to be there, and he just happens to hold him up hostage, and they just happen to go to the planet, which just happens to have this people, and they happen, and they all just become friends too easy, and they just happen to be at the right place with the right place. And I hate it when Abrams does it, and I detest it here. I still like this better because it's a complete story and it goes somewhere. It's just not a bunch of mystery boxes going nowhere. But if I don't like hyper coincidences like that, I can't like it here. And that's where it's going to suffer a lot of dings for me, because it's okay. There's one final nice thing. I like how in this spaceship, you don't have windows, can't see what things are like, because that would be more realistic. But the way he just get in the spaceship, we're going to planet Mongo. That's it. Like you, any other of the guards, Ming's guards could have held a shotgun up to you and you would have fought him. Zarkov has a gun. Whoa, hang on now. We got to back that up and get on the ship. So that's my main gripe. So I'll let you guys have at it.
You hit two of the big ones right there. And then I think we already touched on any of the other real ones I had. Costumes, some of the fight scenes looked bad. I mean, I don't think there's too much more that I can really go, this was a terrible thing or a negative, really. I mean, it's also a product of its time. I'm going to accept some of it.
Without rehashing what Rage Master said, I don't understand. The ending is just too convenient. Ming decides to basically commit suicide by going to be with the great god Tao or whatever it is and walk through the tunnel of terror. I mean, why?
Yeah.
So the lion men were fighting to overthrow Ming. And so Ming killed himself and now they're willing to be subservient to Princess Aura. What just happened? Why is everything okay now? And Ming is the emperor, but he's somewhat incompetent. And I don't seem to understand why he's the emperor, because everybody seems to be better than him. He's got the Three Stooges as his guards. So the ending of the whole story becomes too convenient. And then why is the priest putting a bomb on Flash Gordon's ship?
Revenge?
But revenge for what?
Right.
He's a stooge and a toady. It doesn't make sense.
This is also the priest that got pushed away by Ming when he was like, you failed, get out of here.
Right.
Yeah. Definitely, you're right. Again.
And is the bombs triggered by a sand glass, an hourglass? What? Huh?
Yeah. That doesn't really make sense. This is some of it is the product of the time. And that's why I said I can't really 100% go against it, because it is what it is.
Well, right. I mean, remember, we have to consider that it's kind of like the original Fallout games. People are going to envision the future the way they would think the future would look like. And they're going to picture it partially as the culture they live in. In the same way that right now we picture the future with digital tablets and things like that. But for all we know, come in the future, that's people are going to look back and be like, ha, I can't believe you guys thought we'd be using those still.
I mean, they couldn't fathom the transistor at that time to be able to make things as small as they are today. So anything that had, you know, it had, right. had tubes.
Yeah.
Right. So
again, the transistor was the biggest leap technology wise, pretty much since almost anything going back. I mean, you could have almost gone. Say the wheel.
Oh yeah, everything changes with the transistor. Nothing that we have.
Miniaturized.
Sorry.
Yeah. And this was definitely made before then, before anyone could even imagine things like that.
Right. I don't know if this is good or bad, but also the side swipe was heavily influenced Lucas, obviously, from this.
Oh yeah, all the different wipes that they used.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a move. I mean,
okay.
Used properly, it's good. Just not overly used, not used improperly.
Okay. Any other gripes we got or cheers or jeers before we rate this thing?
None from me.
I think we covered it all.
All right. So let's, how many... what was it? How many sacred dragons do we give this? Sacred dragon chicken lobsters do we give this?
Who wants to start?
I'll start this time. 7. Because it influenced space opera. Many of the wonderful things that we have now came from it. It is a good, fun story. It's that Odyssey, but it loses a lot of points for the things I mentioned before. That the just complete coincidences and lack of hero's journey development just made me say, I mean, there is slightly a hero's journey. It was foisted upon him, but you didn't really see him train or get better because he was kicking butt from the beginning. So I have to I had to dock it for that. But it was still fun, and it was the influence is something that I cannot deny.
All right. I'm going to probably give an 8. I mean, it, again, has some problems. It definitely does. But I have to, A, take it for a product of its time, but it was also entertaining. I mean, I never really sat there going, this is boring, I can't stand this, when is it going to end? From beginning to end, I was able to watch it and enjoy pretty much every moment of it. So that's going to get some very high scores.
I'm going to split the difference here and give it a 7.5. 7.5 lobster chicken Zoidberg monsters. It was fun. It was entertaining. It's just a fast-paced story. There's not a lot of meat to it. I mean, there's nothing really to go in and deconstruct and dissect, and it's not making a poignant statement about society, but it was fun. And I honestly might put on the follow-up 1938 serial and watch through that and see and follow the story and see where it goes.
I was thinking that too.
It's one of those things that, like, I don't know if I'd rewatch it, but it was fun and there's value to it. So I can't say much bad about it.
Mm. Well, that's what's that, Thomas?
I said overall, we seem to all approve of this.
Yeah,
it's definitely my favorite of the three that we've watched.
Agreed.
I kind of like Fighting Devil Dogs a little better, but it definitely was fun to watch this. And I agree, Scott. I'll probably watch the Trip to Mars and then Flash Gordon Conquers the Universe. So. And I'll keep my eye out in case Wahidi winds up making a new movie. So, real quick, for next week, we're going to be watching, it's going to be our last episode of this month. We're going to be watching Undersea Kingdom, which is quite a famous one. Again, I picked this solely because I saw a bunch of clips from Muppet Babies. But it also came up as a big science fiction serial on a Google search. So of the many choices, this is the one I picked. And we have a nice extra special treat too. You might have, we're going to be joined by Don from Don's Breakfast Cereal. he's going to be with us. So, and he's the one who we keep referring. This is where we're getting all our cereals from, his YouTube channel. So he's going to be joining us on this review, and he'll have a lot to say. We interviewed him at Ghoularity Fest, you might remember, but we're going to be getting him in an actual review, and I'm really looking forward to that. So he seemed adamant, and I know I am. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking with Don again. He's a good guy.
He's a cool guy. Yeah.
Don's awesome.
We could find out how much he's going to get for that rare Ultimate Collector's Edition coaster. Okay. Which, yeah. By the way, Ethan, you are going to get one. It turns out at the bottom of my shirt bag, there is one more. So you're getting one, too, which means, Ethan, please do email us for your with your mailing address that you're comfortable with and shirt size. And we'll get one to you right away, along with the ultra rare collectible coaster. But don't tell Don. Don't tell Don. So, and I think that puts us at the end. But beyond just Ethan, what if someone wants to contact us, Scott?
Well, the best way to do that is to leave us a message at our website at RavingLunaticMedia.com. 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 You can find us on Facebook at Raving Lunatic Media. You can also find us on Twitter at Sci-Fi Malady. What's left for them to do, Rage Master?
Star Suck, suckers!
Not that sickness. And watch out for Carol Baskin.